Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn more about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we look at how we've adapted to a new normal during the pandemic. From the business of restauranteering and the new habits of composters, to learning from the past to prepare for the future, we're exploring what came before and what lies ahead.
People in charge of the collections and the acquisitions looked at me and were like, what the hell are you trying to sell me cookery for?
These kids are so young and we're teaching them that it's okay to throw out all this food, and we have to figure out a way to educate these students to make them, you know, lifelong environmentalists.
Tune in to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts for the latest stories in the world of food.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. For those of you who are just, what a ridiculous thing to say. You wouldn't have picked this podcast if you didn't know what it was. So never mind any of that. Today we're going to talk about the beef cattle markets. We are speaking today with Ben Gottschall, who is the Policy and Research Director for the Organization for Competitive Markets, and he brings with him a lifetime of agricultural experience, as well as a background in organizing, research, and writing. I'm going to read Ben's whole bio only because I loved it so much and because it represented so many different interests. Ben was born and raised on a cattle ranch in the sandhills of Southwest Holt County, Nebraska, and is a fifth-generation rancher who spent many hours as a child guessing cattle weights at the Atkinson Livestock Market, where his grandpa Dean was the order buyer. I want you to know, Ben, that I, too, have successfully guessed cattle weights, and I did not grow up on a ranch, but never mind. Although most of his occupations have been agricultural, he has also published a full-length book of poetry and taught college English. Ben previously worked as the Energy and Agriculture Director for Bold, Nebraska. He has been a past county and district president of the Nebraska Farmers Union, where he now serves on the board of directors. He lives near Raymond, Nebraska, with his wife Tammy and their daughter Charlotte, and together they own the Davy Road Ranch and operate Holt Creek Jerseys, a dairy cattle and genetics business. Ben is a founding owner of Lone Tree Foods, a local food wholesale and distribution company serving the Lincoln and Omaha areas. That's a fantastic bio. Like, you just have had your fingers in so many different pies, and you are, even though you're a fifth generation cattle rancher, you are anything but typical in my experience. Would you consider yourself a typical rancher with the poetry and the college professor and the...
No, I wouldn't consider myself typical, but... But we all have, you know, the same job, which is producing food for people. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the program today. So you are the acting interim director for the OCM, right? They're actually searching for somebody to take the executive director position. I won't ask you why you don't want to be the executive director. I can imagine it's just a number of huge headaches. So, but I have spoken in the past. I've had many people on from the OCM, actually, especially Mike Weaver. And as you know, Mike Calicrate has been a guest many times for my show.
Yes.
Both of them, fountains of wisdom. Really terrific. But let's start with your, you had a recent press release that calls for a moratorium on foreign meat imports, which I think is a really interesting and important topic for the American consumer to be aware of. So tell us a little bit about that press release and what is the, you know, what's the beef jerky? Sorry, I make bad jokes all the way through this. You'll get used to it.
Okay. Well, I got to confess, part of it was just kind of reactionary and opportunistic because that same week, President Trump, you know, mentioned it in a press event at the White House. And, you know, he basically said something in public that, that we agree with policy wise. And so we wanted to let him and Sonny Perdue know that we agreed with that, that statement, that, that strategy of stopping imports. And then, you know, basically, kind of calling attention to why, and in particularly, you know, that release mentioned Brazilian imports. You know, we've long kind of had a, had a tough situation there with JBS and the Batista brothers. You know, they got caught doing many things, which I don't need to go all into those things, but we, you know, the safety of Brazilian meat from JBS has been called into question in the past. So there's,
yes, it that, has.
There's the food safety issue, but also, you know, in the absence of country of origin labeling, which, you know, was repealed about 5 years ago, we just have a way to differentiate imported beef from beef raised in the United States, and it's allowed to be labeled as a product of the USA. So you've got importation happening, which on its face isn't a bad thing, but when you allow those imports to compete on the shelf as if they were American products, we feel that's fraudulent labeling. And it also allows these companies to import cheap trim, which is then put into the ground beef that, that is then kind of, I don't necessarily want to say adulterated, although it has happened in the past where there were recalls, but it just kind of cheapens the product and then allows those products to compete, we think, unfairly with, you know, the domestic product that, that is not commingled with imported trim from who knows where. And
so we're talking primarily about trim, right? We're talking trim. We're not talking whole muscle cuts, right?
Well,
we use a lot of trim in this country.
Sure. In this case, we would be talking about whole muscle cuts. For the reason I mentioned before, because of the labeling issue.
Huh. So you could, so in other words, you're saying that the, because, okay, so say JBS slaughters a beef cow in Brazil and then cuts it into, you know, quarters, right? And then ships those quarters to the United States where it is further processed into whole muscle cuts, then it can be labeled as a product of the USA. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
So obviously they're going to get a much, and so the price differential between what they're buying from Brazil and what they would be paying an American beef producer is significant. Can you give us an estimate of how, what the differential is in price between, say, buying a steak that originates from Brazil compared to a steak that originates from your ranch?
I'm not sure about the exact pricing, but the real issue, at least from an antitrust, you know, anti-competition perspective, is they own that beef. So when JBS imports beef that they own, that, that's kind of already gone through their system in Brazil, they own that beef, and that, and they are using that supply to manipulate price via demand. So, you know, when, gotcha. When, why would they can basically take what they have invested in that product and use that to leverage the price that they are paying for beef in the United States. And so
I see,
you know, they're in a way they're pitting the Brazilian rancher who we believe they're also exploiting against the American rancher. And that's just
yes.
unfair competition. We don't have the same standards. We don't have all the same economic situations in both countries, and it's just a really really tricky game that they play there.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. So most of your organization supports the idea that the American government should place a moratorium on imports from other countries. I would assume that Australia is included in this, right? Because their cattle is also significantly cheaper than American produced beef, right?
Yes. And, you know, like I said before, in absence of country of origin labeling, we don't really have any other mm-hmm. choice. You know, we're not opposed to competition. You know, we're the Organization for Competitive Markets, but we feel that
right.
labeling, you know, the Australian beef or beef from Uruguay or now Namibia is legally importing beef to the U.S. Is, like I said, we believe it's fraudulent labeling, and that's not fair competition. Mm-hmm. We believe, and mm-hmm. consumers do want the right to choose what they're purchasing, to know where it comes from, and to make a choice based on, you know, what they want to support. And so the demand,
sure,
you know, the demand for American raised beef is there. Country of origin labeling doesn't really create demand. The demand already exists. Country of origin labeling just aligns the demand, the consumers demanding a product, with the product that they actually want.
Right. So would you say that most cattle producers agree with your position, or is it primarily independents like the guys who participate in the OCM or the other organization called RCAF that Bill Bullard runs? Is it mostly sort of guys like you who I think of as more independent, or is this a position that is also being supported by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association?
I do not believe the NCBA supports that position. But yes, you're right. I'd say most independent cattle producers would agree. And, you know, you mentioned RCAF. They did circulate a petition about country of origin labeling. I think they got, last time I saw, they were getting close to or maybe even went over 300,000 signatures on that.
Sure.
And so, you know, a big portion of that is producers, but then, you know, consumers, like I said, consumers are weighing in on this too now. And you're
right.
seeing kind of an awareness, especially, you know, since the COVID-19 pandemic and its effects have been made evident. You know, a lot of consumers are starting to pay attention to these things where, you know, just 6 months ago, maybe not as many of them were quite tuned into some of these issues.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one reason why I'm picking this up. I've actually done quite a bit of programming around country of origin labeling, which I fully support. You know, when it was repealed, I was really, I was dismayed. And also I felt, as you did and many of your brethren do, that it's extremely unfair. So what role does the national, let's go back for a second and talk about the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, because they have not been supporters of country of origin labeling or even, you know, produced in the USA type labeling. And they, yet at the same time, they are absorbing checkoff dollars from every pound of beef that is sold in the United States. Why is there a disconnect between what the National Cattlemen's Beef Association supports and what the average American rancher supports?
Well, the short answer is because the meat packers are part of the NCBA now, they throw their weight around, and you know they have a lot of control and influence, and not just in that organization, but in others, and you know it's kind of a classic case of in a way agency capture. We see, you know, it's not regulatory in this case, but we see other agencies like the USDA having quite a revolving door and quite a bit of what we would call conflict of interest, where, you know, the majority, I think, of NCBA's members are cattle producers. The question is, does that entity fully represent the best interests of all of its members? And we would argue that they don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would argue that too. So you're saying the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is primarily made up of cattle producers, and yet you're also saying that all four of the major beef packers, which would be Cargill, JBS, Tyson, and who's the fourth one? National? Is that still National?
Yes.
So you're saying that they throw their weight around within the NCBA. So most of the legislative impact that the cattle markets can have on their local on their elected representatives would be coming from the NCBA, not organizations like the OCM or CAF. Is that right also?
Well, yes, they do have tremendous influence in Washington and with lawmakers. And mm-hmm. you know, that's part of what we're trying to find out. You know, what portion of the NCBA's budget is spent on lobbying? Mm-hmm. And, you know, back in 2010, an audit of just 9 days of the beef checkoff program found that there was more than $200,000 in improper spending, including lobbying. And so, you know, then a full audit was performed, but it was never released to the public because the USDA basically didn't want to embarrass itself. And we're still fighting the USDA to turn over that information through a FOIA request in 2014. And, you know, we have a lawsuit that's pending in that matter.
Mm-hmm. So during the pandemic, what happened with the beef processing as well as pork production, and I think to some extent poultry, is that with only the option of relatively few slaughterhouses, correct me if I'm wrong at any time, Ben, I just want to make sure people understand that what happened here was we started importing more beef because we had bottlenecks in our own production lines because of the pandemic, which shut down or diminish the capacity for production in a variety of these beef plants. Is that correct? Am I right about that?
Imports didn't necessarily dramatically increase at that time, but you know what did was mm-hmm. exports. You know, back in April, you know, Smithfield and Tyson were warning us of shortages. And then in April, they exported a record amount of pork to China. So,
I didn't want to get into the pork thing, but yes, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
So, you know, there was meat in cold storage. There was beef in cold storage. We were importing beef. Yes. But the shortages, you know, were mostly due to the supply chain, you know, and the supply was for the most part there for the restaurant and the schools, but the demand for that just went away. And so you saw what you saw with almost all other sectors of the food supply, where you had this system kind of geared toward producing these products for a certain market, and it wasn't set up to produce them for the high demand we saw for individuals via grocery stores.
So it wasn't for the consumer. Right.
Right. Yeah. We saw a processing bottleneck, not only in the big major, you know, big four meat packing plants, but also in every little small town locker and butcher plant all across the country.
Because the loss of the institutional buyer. So they could no longer, they were not nimble enough to be able to switch their processing needs or processing to a consumer market and grocery stores, as opposed to sending it into larger institutions. Am I understanding that correctly?
Sure. Or in the case of the smaller plants, they were just overwhelmed with ranchers that had animals that needed to be, that, you know, were ready for slaughter, ready for butchering. And then you have the customers who were looking to find beef because they weren't finding it in the grocery store.
Right, right. So let's talk for a second again about the country of origin labeling, because that was abandoned. And I just want people to understand this, because this really is kind of a crux issue in my mind. just to go back to that, so when the country of origin labeling was abandoned or repealed, that was largely, according to the government, that was because the World Trade Organization ruled in favor of Canada and Mexico and against, cattle ranchers, because they were going to, Canada and Mexico were saying, well, people will never buy our beef if it's labeled Canadian or Mexican. So that was considered unfair competition. So how does labeling it product of USA differ from country of origin labeling? Explain how that's going to work. Like, if you guys manage to get that rammed through, how will that not be the same problem?
Well, it might. I mean, it would be the same problem. And the, yeah, the fact of the thought. Matter is there's a big question about the standing and whether or not Canada and Mexico should be allowed to sue us for that. There's even been some in the industry question whether or not the U.S. should even be in the WTO. You know, there's actually a push for that right now. You've got Josh Hawley in Missouri, you know, pushing for the U.S. to withdraw from the WTO. And so, that issue is kind of one of those things that kind of points to one of the trade-offs to being part of the World Trade Organization, is that you open yourself up for these types of lawsuits and actions that are basically meant to not force our hand, but establish a position that basically demands we react in a certain way when it comes to our, you know, how we use our imports. So it's a tricky thing because, you know, some people some people say, well, go ahead and let them sue us. And what are they going to do? You know, so there's some that kind of have this hard line stance of, well, we don't have to, you know, we don't have to do what Canada and Mexico want us to do. But then others, you know, they're our closest, obviously, North American trading partners. And so it basically, we weren't willing to challenge them. I'll just put it that way. We weren't willing to take them on, so to speak, in that legal kind of arena that they took it to. And so, you know, I don't know what would have happened had we done that. There may have been some sort of legal process that determined a finding, and we might have lost, but at least we would know. Now, right now, we're wondering why some of us are wondering why we didn't just, you know, put the earplugs in and keep going. So where we are today,
I've heard other people's,
So where we are today, you know, 5 years later, after not having country of origin labeling, are we any better off, you know, look from a trade perspective, from a beef industry perspective? And I think most ranchers would say no. So there's that. Yeah. But go ahead.
I was going to suggest or say was that the fines that were being proposed were fairly significant, but other people who, you know, discussed this issue with me at the time also said the fines compared to the overall profit margins of the beef industry are minimal, and we should have just gone ahead and paid the damn fines and continued with country of origin labeling. So it seemed to me that the country of origin labeling issue was, or the withdrawal from that was largely driven by the packers. Would you agree with that?
I would.
Because they, of course, want to import cheap beef to mix with trim or whatever, and then sell it. And that also obviously has, as you said at the top of the program, has a tremendous impact on the prices that you get. So let me, before we take a quick break for a sponsor drop, I just want to understand why, I want you to explain to me why beef prices are so freaking high right now. Like, I mean, unbelievable. Like, I've never seen them this high. And yet you guys don't seem to be getting that piece of the pie. So what's happening there in the price market?
Well, you know, you've got the price of wholesale beef and you got the price of retail beef. And so when customers see the price of retail beef on the shelf, they immediately, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of follow the chain back. They think, oh, the grocery stores are gouging us. And then they go yeah. from there and say, oh, well, the farmers must be gouging us. They don't often think about that there's that real big gap in the middle. And for lack of a better term, I just call it good old fashioned grift and greed.
Thank you.
You know, I think the big meat packers saw the writing on the wall and thought, well, if we got to close down plants, we're going to have mm-hmm. to, we've got to make a profit for our shareholders. We're going to have, that money's going to have to come from somewhere. So if it's not going to come from our usual volume, it's going to have to come from a higher price. And that's when that happened, when those prices continued to climb, through the month of April and May, that's when the attention started to focus on the pricing of beef. And that's when you saw kind of the pile on with, you know, senators and other folks calling for investigations of, you know, price fixing in the meatpacking industry, which had been going on since the Holcomb, the Tyson plant fire in Holcomb, Kansas.
Right. That's right. Okay. I'm going to stop you there. We're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop. And we'll be right back with Ben Gottschall from the Organization for Competitive Markets. Stay tuned. We're going to talk more about deconstructing the cattle market and trying to figure out how to make this work better for everyone. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their beautiful red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile makes them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
And we are back with Ben Gottschall. We're talking about price fixing now. Part of the interesting developments that are ongoing in the meat industry across the board. I don't think that the price fixing is anything new. It just seems to be higher. They seem to have, you know, ratcheted it up to a higher price point than they have in the past. So would you assume that that's why it suddenly is drawing scrutiny from senators? Or is it just kind of, I don't think there's been any come to Jesus moment with senators who get huge amounts of money from, packing companies, for their campaigns. I'm wondering what really is going on here, that they're suddenly paying attention to that and also the consolidation in the market. I mean, that these are all things that have been going on now for decades. So what do you think has really brought this to a head?
Well, I think it's just gotten bad enough. I mean, it's been consolidation has been on an upward trajectory, you know, for the last 40 years. And I think it's just finally gotten bad enough where, you know, we saw shortages, and we saw the fragility of such a hugely consolidated system, you know, where just the closure of one or two or three major plants can totally disrupt the whole food supply chain. I think, you know, it went from something that policy folks like me were talking about, cattle producers and producer groups were talking about, to something that consumers could see and feel, and something, and that includes all of us. So it kind of, it kind of democratized the impact, I guess you might say, where it wasn't just, It wasn't just the farmers and ranchers who are a minority of the population, and it wasn't just the people in the know. It folks got a real quick education when they went to their grocery store and there was no meat on the shelf, and then when there was a lot more expensive than before. That gets people's attention, and then they start calling their local leaders, their state senators, their congressmen, and wanting to know what's going on. So, I don't want to say it's a good thing, but I think that it's an opportunity to try to figure these things out. And so the increased scrutiny, the increased attention to these issues is welcome. And my hope is that we can actually get some kind of substantive change and some type of reform to move forward and not allow it to continue and not ever allow it to get to this point again.
Mm-hmm. You'd think that the various, like the Sherman Act, and there's another big act that was enacted in the early part of the 20th century, would have like protected you a little bit more than it has. But it does, as you said, it's been going on for about four decades, really since the beginning of what we think of as the neoliberal globalization, right? I mean, I'm new to all of this, relatively. But that's sort of my understanding, is that it started really with sort of the Reagan-Thatcher era, where we suddenly began, driving prices down by going to other countries to get cheaper and cheaper, cheaper labor, cheaper product, et cetera. Do you feel like the United States, to go back to sort of our whether or not we withdraw from the World Trade Organization, which I think is a really interesting question and something worth an entire program, but would you say that aside from importing cheap beef at the expense of American farmers, would you say that the American, that the USDA and, et al. Are doing a good job of negotiating good trade deals vis-a-vis our livestock agricultural products? Or are we getting hosed somehow?
I'm
very unclear about that.
When it comes to how USDA represents livestock producers, you don't have to look any further than how, in particular, this USDA, although it's definitely not the first administration to kind of kick the can down the road, but just look at their treatment of the Packers and Stockyards Act. Look at their treatment of the Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration. Donald Trump and Sonny Perdue basically just gutted GPSA. They shelved it. There's no director. There's no deputy director. There is no GPSA anymore. And that was the administration solely responsible with enforcement of the Packers and Stockyards Act. And so they moved it into the AMS, the Agriculture Marketing Service. They moved it into the AMS, and then they released their rulemaking process and totally dismantled any semblance of producer protection in that rulemaking process. I mean, they basically, in so many words, said, "We're not gonna revisit past cases. There's already been a precedent set that producers, farmers and ranchers don't have legal standing to prove competitive harm." And we're just going to say that if a practice is customary in the industry, then it must be okay because it must be good for business. And so basically, in so many words, they said, we're going to codify the meatpacker abuses of farmers and ranchers. We're going to basically make it legal for them to do that. And then we're going to kick the last leg out from under any legal standing that these farmers and ranchers ever had and require them to prove competitive harm to the whole industry, not just to themselves. So if I make a complaint as a farmer about non-competitive practices or some abuse that I feel I've suffered, I have to prove that that has happened and that that has affected every sector of the industry, that it affects all farmers and ranchers. And that's impossible. Right. It's an impossible burden of proof. And so that's what the USDA has done. they have completely eliminated producer protections. So if that tells you anything, what they're doing in our country representing our interests, I don't understand how they could possibly be representing our best interests in trade agreements that we're not even a party to.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a state that I did not know. Now, so let's just unpack that for a second. So you're saying the Trump administration came in and was voted in largely by the agricultural community. I mean, that was a big, because he promised that he was going to take care of farmers. And I'm assuming that he meant livestock farmers as well. And instead, he dismantled GPSA, which had been Obama and Vilsack had been trying to change those rules. Am I right? I mean, we're going back 10 years now, which is when I first started learning about GPSA and you know, the Packers and Stockyards Act and the whole grain inspection, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
So they were trying to modernize that and create more protections for producers. And yet when Trump came in, farmers and ranchers voted for him because did he promise he was going to continue those reforms, or did he announce that he was going to do away with them and people applauded that? I just don't understand how he pulled the wool over everybody's eyes in the agricultural community, I guess is what I'm saying here. What happened there?
Well, you know, the mantra for the rate, you know, you mentioned the Reagan era antitrust non-enforcement, I would call it, was efficiency. Yeah. Efficiency, efficiency, right. Efficiency. So, you know, to the public or to, you know, to folks who maybe aren't quite as deep into this as the folks that were trying to get these reforms passed. Oh, it, you know, cutting out an agency, reducing that spending, so to speak, and making the whole, you know, the whole administration more efficient, that might sound good. But really, it was just getting rid of checks and balances. So, you know, AMS, Agriculture Marketing Service, basically works hand in hand with the meat packers. And GPSA was the only check and balance to that power. And so
that's right.
By getting rid of GPSA or putting it in a storage unit somewhere, you know, that just basically eliminated any power that the producers would have had to get to seek relief for the practices that have been snowballing, you know, for the last 40 years.
Right.
And yeah, it's maddening to know that, you know, yes, a bulk of President Trump's supporters came from folks in the farming and ranching community. But you know, and it remains to be seen what the full effect of some of these policies will be.
Do you think farmers and ranchers will continue to support the Trump administration and vote for him again? This is completely, this is just, you know, that's just me. Just me asking. From a completely partisan standpoint, mind you. Because, of course, I hate him deeply. But anyway, yeah.
It's
so
hard to
what
say.
Do you think? Do you think your cohort will continue to support Sonny Perdue as U.S. Ag Secretary and Donald Trump as president in the face of these, you know, abuses, basically?
From what I've seen in my conversations and in interactions, I would say farmers and ranchers are less thrilled with Sonny Perdue than they are with Trump. Because, you know, Sonny Perdue is kind of the face of the USDA. And so everything comes down from the USDA, even though he was, you know, hired by the president. There's kind of been an outcry for Sonny Perdue to kind of get with the program and start listening to the concerns of farmers and ranchers. And, you know, he called for the investigation of the meatpacking companies. He did respond to our letter that we sent calling on a moratorium on imports. He said that agricultural trade is very important to our economy. And if I was struggling to apply for the CFAP program, so that was, kind of a non-answer to a pretty serious issue. And most yeah, definitely. I would say the whole agency, the whole USDA has kind of been upended by this administration. You know, there've been funding cuts, there've been kind of location, you know, there's the ERS.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, it's just kind of this whole shakeup in general, not just as it pertains to antitrust or livestock, but it's just kind of an agency wide shakeup, for lack of a better term.
Right. Fascinating. We don't have too much more time. At least I don't want to keep you too much longer, because I really appreciate this. But one of the things that, you know, and you can say, I don't want to answer this question, but I was wondering, like, what about large, speaking to the concept of a moratorium on imports of beef and, well, primarily beef, we export all our other animal products. But what about that? What if you had like large institutional buyers, and I mean really large, like the fast food chains, for example, what if they said, we're not going to buy beef that isn't produced in the United States? Would that have an impact on the way things shake out for you guys? Like, would you, you know, is that something that would help your market? Is it something that you would consider lobbying for directly to an organization like McDonald's or, you know, one of the other big fast food chains like Yum, or, you know, all of the guys that are international in scope?
Sure. Well, you know, those companies are big buyers, and they have a lot of marketplace. They have a lot of power and a lot of influence in the marketplace. So there's no question that if one of the fast food chains or quote unquote burger joints decided that they were going to take that stance and use that as a promotion, you know, because that would be why they would do it.
Yeah, of course.
I think it would have an influence. But one example that we can point to is Walmart. You know, nobody buys more beef than Walmart, and they opted out of the vertically integrated system and decided to go ahead on their own and vertically integrate themselves. And so even Walmart was kind of tired of being in the same pool as the big four meat packers, and they just struck out on their own. So, you know, there's always that possibility too, that these big companies, like you mentioned McDonald's and there's others, they could just decide to totally kind of vertically integrate their own supply chain. That's not out of the question.
That would not be good.
It's already happened. No, we don't think that would be good either. So, you know, it depends on how that would take form. You know, it depends on what it would look like should they choose to make that choice and make that change. But I think from a public relations standpoint, I think it would be something consumers would get behind. That would probably be what the motivation would be there.
So would say your organization or RCAF, you know, Bill Bullard's outfit, would you guys ever lobby? Do you ever meet with organizations like, you know, large corporations like McDonald's and say, hey, what about it? Like, take the vertical integration off the table. Don't become a Walmart, but, you know, extend, you know, American ranchers' first dibs, say, let them compete on the basis of price or whatever, you know, standards or, you know, who knows, whatever criteria they decide is appropriate. But then only buy from American independent ranchers. Like, do you guys go after that kind of, you know, goal, for lack of a better word? I mean, it seems to me that's kind of like, you know, exploiting the need for corporate social responsibility, which is sort of, you know, making bigger and bigger inroads into the corporate mentality. It seems to me that would be a very, you know, like fertile ground for you guys to exploit in terms of trying to force the hand of the government vis-a-vis importing meat from elsewhere. I know that was
not a strategy that we've explicitly employed in the past, but mm-hmm. it's not counter to our goals and counter to our mission. but it is difficult to break through that kind of corporate wall, because that's kind of what we've been fighting for so long. Is we've been fighting to keep big corporations from having that kind of power, to the point where one buyer or one customer, so to speak, could dictate so many things down the ladder, you know? So it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting concept. I would say all options are on the table, you know, all possibilities, mm-hmm. Should be considered. But something that I haven't mentioned yet, that I think is very important in all this is when I say producers, I'm including farm labor and meatpacking labor in the definition of that term. So I'm not just talking about farmers and ranchers. There has to be the food supply system has to be equitable. It has to be fair for the people who are doing the work of meatpacking themselves. And so whether that's happening in the United States, where we have some degree of control over the standards for those workers, and we should continue to fight for making those standards better. But yeah. You know, we have virtually no control over what happens in the meatpacking plants in South America, for example, where JBS has been ordered to close plants due to worker welfare during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And
not just then either. I mean, the conditions in foreign meatpacking, especially in South America, are that's another whole subject. I mean, it's just they are basically slave labor, even more than they are in this country. And we could do a whole show on the way people are treated in meatpacking plants in this country. We're not going to go there. But okay, I have to wrap this up because 45 minutes is about the limit of people's attention span, unfortunately. But I have one more question for you, Ben, and then I'll let you go. So if you were king of beef, if you were the king, what would be the steps that you would take to change the face of the industry as it exists today? Huge question, of course, but you know, like a couple of bullet points.
Well, I would structurally separate the big meatpacking companies, and you know, separate slaughter from processing, so that the slaughtering is not happening in the same building as the processing. Split those enterprises apart. And I would make it, I would not allow companies that produce boxed beef, which they are selling to grocers and retailers, to be further processed. Would not allow those companies to also sell retail product, because that's a conflict of interest. They are basically, they're controlling the price of both, and they're competing with their own customers on that. And so structurally separating slaughter from processing in those larger plants, and when you go to slaughter only in those big facilities, then you can disperse, then you can decentralize and make more smaller processing facilities in the, you know, in more areas, in more smaller towns. Mm-hmm. So and that would include increasing the number of plants, the smaller plants out in the country. And so basically just decentralizing all of it. We've got to have a more distributed system where more farmers and businesses can operate in more places to add more value to the product and produce a higher quality product that actually benefits the local economies where the cattle are produced, where the livestock are raised, where the eaters are. And we've got to start from the top down, and we've got to start from the ground up. And so somewhere in the middle, I think is the solution to making a more equitable system.
Okay, great. Listen, Ben, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back. Good conversation. Promote your organization shamelessly. Where can people find out more information? They can subscribe for a newsletter, for example, right?
Yeah.
Talk about that for a second.
Sure. It's an organization, So it's an organization for competitive markets. We're on Facebook, and then we also have a website at competitivemarkets.com. We do put together, so there's all kinds of pages and links there. You can join, you can become a member, you can support us. And then, yes, we do put out quite a bit of information. We put out a weekly newsletter. We put out a weekly kind of news roundup of the prevalent stories from the week. And then we do put out a bi-monthly newsletter that is kind of has some more in-depth, longer articles that we produce ourselves about the important issues for our organization.
Right, right. Anyway, I highly recommend the website. I learn a lot from it. I am a subscriber myself. So which is which is why I have some sense of what's going on, but not obviously, as you could see, not the firmest grasp, but pretty close. Ben, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you, folks, for listening. We're going to be talking dairy next week with a couple of local farmers here in the great state of Little Rhodey. So please do tune in for that. And Ben, thanks again for joining me today. And let's stay in touch as this, you know, as these various issues move through both the court system and the court of public opinion. And we'll see what happens. Thanks a lot for your time. And thanks to my sponsor. And we'll see you next week. That's it for now. So long. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.